Okay, I think we'll pick up our discussion of antifungal. We'll do it sort of slowly as a couple people come in. Let me just say the quiz on Monday is on antifungal, even though we're going to start into malaria, okay? And the exams are almost done being graded, and I'm hopeful that they will be, I don't do this, so I'm dependent on somebody else to do it, put up into cyberspace for you to look at by the end of maybe tomorrow. You know, I haven't even done it. So I'm just, I got the Scantrons back and I graded the discussion questions and I was hyper generous. Okay? No, I was very generous. It was so benevolent. You would think it was Christmas, okay? But it, okay? Your creativity was awesome. Crap, you thought of things that I hadn't thought about ever, okay? But that's okay. Such is life. And if we have a second after at the end, one of these days I'll be happy to go through it. Okay, let me say one more thing before we move on to one last drug, and then we'll come back and look at the drugs used to treat systemic mycoses. And that is, if you look in package inserts, etc., you will be informed that amphotericin B and azoles are contraindicated. In other words, you don't use the two together. Why might that be? Here you got a good drug and another really good drug. Why not put the two together and get a synergistic effect? Yeah? Nay, you lose. That's okay. I'm going to give you a point anyhow because I'm benevolent. Yes. Oh, you got it, baby. He gets extra credit. Okay. Amphotericin B needs the azole to bind to. That's what it's hot for. The azole blocks the synthesis of the ergosterol. I can't talk. The ergosterol, and thus diminishes the effectiveness. We have one more drug, and it's a minor drug, and it's a drug that's used to treat dermatophytes, superficial mycoses, and I want to mention it primarily because of its mechanism of action, but it's also a drug that's still used. And this is the drug called griseofulvene. And interestingly, this is a drug that was produced or is produced by a penicillin mold, the same kind of mold that makes penicillins. And it was identified or isolated. So here's a drug made by a bug to get an advantage. It was isolated, identified, screened, and bombed as an antibacterial, and in the late 50s, pulled off the shelf and reevaluated and shown to have antifungal activity when taken orally for systemic mycoses. And this is its structure, and I'll tell you how it works. When the drug is administered to the patient, we'll look at its pharmacology in just a second, it is actively taken up by susceptible dermatophytes. And it has a preference for binding to keratin precursor cells. We said dermatophytes love to eat keratin. Keratin-rich sites, nails, hair being examples thereof. It binds to keratin precursor cells and it inhibits fungal mitosis. It inhibits the ability of the mitosis to be completed. It inhibits the metaphase step. And it does it by binding to tubulin that makes up the microtubules that are involved in the construction of the mitotic spindle. So the drug is actively taken up, binds to tubulin, inhibits mitosis at metaphase by binding to the tubulin polymer. Now, the reason I mention this is we're going to see other drugs, this is a sweet national board question, okay, you can smell it, that have similar mechanisms that are out in the cancer arena. So this drug works at this step to inhibit mitosis. Resistance does occur to griseofulvene, and when you see it, it's because the active uptake of the drug is impaired. Now this drug, yes, I'm sorry. The drug is concentrated in keratin precursor cells, then taken up. Okay? Yes.
Is it stabilizing the microtubules?
It's stabilizing, in other words, is it inhibiting polymerization or is it inhibiting depolymerization? And I believe it is inhibiting polymerization. Okay? But I'm not precise, and I don't know that that's known.
I was just thinking precisely.
In the making of the microtubule, or in the making of the spindle, polymerization and depolymerization is taking place
right.
Concurrently, okay? The question that you're asking, is it inhibiting the building or the deconstruction of the tubule? And I don't know that, okay? But I can find that out because when we get to vinca alkaloids, okay, they affect one or the other. And when we get to Taxol, it affects one and not the other. Yeah?
So what you're saying about the keratin precursors, they just hang out over there?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, this drug is poorly soluble. It is given orally. It's normally given as a microcrystalline prep. That is providing more surface area to improve the bioavailability, or if you like, the dissolution of the drug into solution. Absorption is improved if the drug is taken with food that is fatty. The drug is metabolized to inactive metabolites that are eliminated in the urine. It is a fairly well-tolerated drug, but it has a collection of sort of nuisance side effects. The patient may, and this particularly is early in the course of treatment, that is, during the first week or two of treatment, it is not at all uncommon for the patient to experience dizziness, headache, insomnia, maybe even some hepatitis, very mild changes in liver enzymes. Maybe skin rash will be encountered. Most of these resolve with continued treatment and would not necessitate termination of treatment. The drug also is an inducer of drug metabolism. It is an inducer of the cytochrome P450 isozyme 3A4 that's involved in the metabolism, for example, of warfarin. But this is one of the drugs that can also increase the metabolism of estrogens and diminish the effectiveness of oral contraceptives. The drug is given orally to treat superficial mycoses of fingernails, toenails, for example. And as a result, requires fairly long duration of treatment, anywhere from a couple months up to 6 months. So these nuisance side effects then become of somewhat of a concern. Now, before we leave this area, I want to go back to the original picture, and that is we've been looking at drugs that are used to treat systemic mycoses. We looked at amphotericin B. We looked at flucytosine, and then we looked at the azoles. There are some other drugs that are used. Some of these are over-the-counter preps used for the management of superficial mycoses. We looked at griseofulvene. Then there are three drugs, miconazole, econazole, clotrimazole. All of these are azoles that are not effective against systemic organisms or have a higher degree of toxicity, but are used, you find them in preparations for athlete's foot, etc., various topical over-the-counter. Now, there's one other drug here before we leave this list, and this is nystatin. And nystatin is a polyene antibiotic. So it's like amphotericin B. It works like amphotericin B, but it is not as effective and it is more toxic than amphotericin B. And its use is primarily in the management, and it is used orally to manage infections in the GI tract. When it is taken orally, in fact, it even involves or can be used as a gargle or a mouthwash to treat infections in the oral cavity. When it is taken orally, it is not absorbed and therefore passes down the GI tract and is effective in the GI tract. It is a polyene antibiotic. So as to be complete, let me just periodically, you see nuggets of truth in the newspaper. One of the uses of these antifungal drugs is in the treatment of infections of fingernails and toenails. There are pricey drugs, itraconazole being one such, that can be used for months, which is a drug company's dream, to treat. But then there's a home remedy that was reported in the newspaper, and I'll just point out the details. But basically, it involves Vicks VapoRub. And the idea is to reduce the biomass of the fungus on the infected nail, fingernail or toenail, to the minimum, and then basically twice a day, apply, swab on Vicks VapoRub. And there's evidence, okay, that this cheap, simple remedy is effective, but not 100%. Okay, I'm trying to save your patients money, okay? We have looked at the treatment of fungal infections. Now we're going to sort of change gears slightly, and we are going to look at the treatment of protozoal infections. And the protozoal infection that we're going to look at is going to be malaria. And let me just put malaria into context for you. clearly this is one of the world's major infectious diseases. In fact, it may be the biggest in terms of morbidity and mortality. It's estimated that somewhere, the numbers are fuzzy, but 100 to 200 million people annually become infected with malaria. It kills 2 to 3 million people a year, and the people that are at greatest risk are pregnant women and children. It is said to cause the greatest harm to the greatest number. And so what we are going to do is look at this disease, but in order to understand the strategy for the use of the drugs to manage it, you got to understand the disease. So here's what we're going to do initially. We're going to describe the bug and its life cycle, and then we're going to look at the mechanism of action for the major drugs and their clinical use, the side effects, and then on Monday late, we'll look at Entamoeba histolytica. So by way of context, malaria is a protozoal infection that is caused by a member of the genus Plasmodium. And this genus Plasmodium, and I have a picture that will facilitate you seeing it. This genus Plasmodium undergoes division asexually, two cycles of asexual development in humans, and one cycle of sexual development in the vector, the Anopheles mosquito. This genus Plasmodium is a pigment-producing genus, and there are four species of Plasmodium that cause malaria in humans. Falciparum and malariae have a lot in common, and Vivax and Ovale have a lot in common. Falciparum malaria is probably responsible for about 20% of all cases of malaria and probably 75% of all deaths. It is, in many ways, the Staphylococcus aureus of malarias. It is also the organism that is highly resistant to a number of anti-malarial drugs. Vivax is the more common, the less lethal form of malaria. So I said that organisms of the genus Plasmodium carry out two cycles of asexual development, and this is called schizogony. I don't make these terms up, okay? I only report them to you accurately. And these two cycles of asexual development occur in the liver, known as exoerythrocytic schizogony, and the other cycle takes place in red blood cells, and that's known as erythrocytic schizogony. And then the organism also has a cycle of sexual development called sporogeny, and this takes place in the female Anopheles mosquito. Do you have it? Okay. What I'd like to do is talk you through the life cycle of the organism, and then we'll look at a case that is sort of classic in terms of symptomology. if you like, except for the printing, this is the life cycle of falciparum malaria. It may even say that here at the bottom. No, it doesn't. So, two cycles of asexual development, one of sexual development. The sexual development occurs in the mosquito. It's called sporogeny, and it gives rise to a form of the organism called sporozoites. And it's the sporozoites that are injected into the host when the mosquito takes a blood meal. So let me orient you to this diagram, because it's really a nice diagram of the life cycle. There are two cycles, one and two, liver and blood, that take place in man, and one cycle that takes place in the mosquito. So let's pick up the story at the point that the mosquito takes a blood meal from an uninfected host. And in the process of taking a blood meal, injects sporozoites into the bloodstream of the host. The sporozoites are injected, and they are rapidly cleared from the blood by the liver, where they initiate the process of exoerythrocytic schizogony. They undergo development and division to produce the primary tissue form that are known as merozoites. This period of time from infection to release of merozoites in falciparum is somewhere in the range of 12 to 14 days, and the patient is asymptomatic. The merozoites are released, and they then are released into the blood. They enter the blood, and they invade and undergo division in red blood cells, carrying out the second stage of asexual development known as erythrocytic schizogony. And this erythrocytic schizogony, depending on the organism, takes several days, and at its completion, the red blood cell lyses, releasing pyrogens, releasing debris, cellular debris, into the blood, and the tissue or the blood form can reinvade new uninfected red blood cells and continue this process. And depending on the development of the disease, the stage of the disease, this may be synchronized. In the case of falciparum, it tends to be fairly spastic. In other words, you don't have the classic picture every 48 hours of a fever spike. This stage is where the patient exhibits symptoms. And this stage then can continue. But not all of the merozoites that are released reinvade red blood cells. Some can differentiate into gametocytes that, when the Anopheles mosquito takes a second blood meal, are taken up, fertilization takes place, and they go and form an oocyst on the outer surface of the stomach, where they carry out the process of sporogeny. The sporogeny gives rise then to, when this oocyst ruptures, to sporozoites that are released, go to the salivary gland, and set up then again the cycle for infection. This stage asymptomatic, this stage has disease. Yes?
I was just wondering, do you differentiate between the different species?
You can. Here's one way you can differentiate. I said that this was This was the life cycle of falciparum and malariae. They do not have a secondary, a relapsing tissue form. Once the tissue stage is fully developed, the organisms move to the red blood cells. Vivax and Ovalle can persist in the liver, having secondary tissue forms, and this can then be a potential pool for new organisms. The drugs we're going to look at to treat this disease are really aimed at three targets. And it depends on where you live and are you a native, are you a visitor? There are a variety of factors determining what the drugs are and how they're used. Here's the strategy. To treat the clinical symptoms, the fever, the ache, the chills, the anemia, there are drugs that work here in the blood, and they're called blood schizanticides. To treat the liver stage of the disease, and particularly to kill off, to remove these relapsing forms of malaria, there are drugs that work in the liver. And then there are some drugs that have effect on gametocytes and this fertilization process. So, that being the nature of the strategy, we're going to talk maybe five drugs at most, maybe six. For treatment, there's probably 105 or 106. But they're all targeted at the same role. Let me begin by showing you a case. And I want you to get the symptoms. Yeah?
When in that cycle do the merozoites get renamed to trozoites?
Lord only knows. When they are at the blood,
okay.
In the blood. There are various stages of development, okay? So when the merozoite leaves the liver, enters the blood, it undergoes another change to a trophozoite that then infects the red blood cell. I'm more interested in you getting a flow than I am in you getting the detail, and I'm very interested in you understanding those, and you really have to understand two and you got four. Okay, this is pure educational synergy. If you understand falciparum and you understand Vivax, you got it. You really have it. And the difference is Vivax has secondary tissue forms in the liver and requires other strategies, okay? But we'll worry about that once you are versed in the drugs that are used to treat. Let me begin by a case. It's a little more detailed case, but here's what I want you to look at. Look at the symptoms of the patient and some of the details here. Gym shoes. Is a 54-year-old Bloomington faculty member who traveled to East Africa on a business trip and then went on a photographic safari. After 1 week in Nairobi, he took a 10-day trip through the wildlife preserves of Serengeti and Ngorongoro, with a final visit to Mombasa on the Indian Ocean. During his flight home, 9 days after leaving the game parks, he developed flu-like symptoms with a headache, muscle aches, and a temperature of 38 degrees. After his return home, he saw his physician who diagnosed influenza, which can cause headache, muscle aches, and fever. He had returned to Indiana in February, and there was an outbreak of influenza A. Mr. Shoes was given acetaminophen, which initially reduced his fever and muscle aches. However, he felt worse the next day, and he suddenly developed an intense chill that lasted about 30 minutes and was followed by a fever of 40 degrees for 6 hours. When the fever abated, he became drenched with sweat, felt exhausted, drained. The symptoms continued to worsen. He was brought to the Bloomington Hospital unconscious 2 days later. On examination, he had edema of the lungs, showed no signs of endocarditis, and a lumbar puncture was negative for meningitis. The attending physician, drawing on her experience while serving in the Peace Corps, recognized the clinical manifestations of Professor Shu's were typical of malaria. The recent history of travel to endemic areas helped to sharpen her suspicion of the disease, and the diagnosis was confirmed with a Gimsa-stained smear of the patient's blood that revealed large numbers of parasites within red blood cells. They were identified as Plasmodium falciparum by their characteristic ring shape. His hematocrit was 18%, normal being 40 to 45. Urine analysis revealed extensive hemolysis. His serum creatinine was 5.4, normal is 1. Treatment was begun with intravenous quinine, which is effective against falciparum strains resistant to more commonly used antimalarial chloroquine. Mr. Shoes was also given intravenous glucose as a precaution against hypoglycemia, which may produce coma in patients with severe falciparum malaria. Hypoglycemia results from both the consumption of glucose by large numbers of parasites and from the direct release of insulin from the pancreas produced by quinine. For his pulmonary edema, he required artificial ventilation with a respirator. He was given multiple transfusions for his anemia and was put on a dialysis machine because of his kidney failure. He recovered and was discharged and was one lucky puppy after spending 10 days in the intensive care unit. This is a pretty dramatic but also classic picture of malaria. And the three features that make one suspicious, particularly given his travel, is fever, chills, and anemia, all of which are dramatically portrayed here. Now, you notice that he suffered from a variety of symptoms, and I'm not a pathologist, but let me just give you a little bit of background as to why this disease does what it does to people like Shoes. And that is, this is simply a picture, but we're going to pick it up here. Here's the red blood cell. Here's the liver stage releasing the merozoites that invade the red blood cell. When red blood cells are invaded by the organism, in the process, and we'll see in a second, of breaking down hemoglobin, they also synthesize sort of knobs or spike material that gets inserted into the membrane of the red blood cell. These the immune system sees as antigens, okay, but their role is to facilitate the attachment of this infected red blood cell to endothelial cells. Endothelial cells of the lung. We saw he had difficulty breathing, the heart, the brain. And these parasitized red blood cells can adhere to the endothelial cell, leading to thrombosis, to minor infarcts, to encephalopathy, congestive heart failure, da-da-da-da-da-da. They also are hard to deform. And so the spleen recognizes them as geriatric, old, useless, and breaks down, and you develop then splenal, hepatic splenomegaly as another side effect. When the red blood cell lyses, when it releases the merozoites, it releases a bunch of debris. It releases hemoglobin, red cell, parasite, some parasite pigment that is phagocytized by the reticuloendothelial system that also is filtered by the kidney, particularly leading to nephrosis, and this contributes to death. I said this is more prominent in pregnant women, probably because the placenta is a good hiding place. This organism hides out. It hides out intracellularly. It hides out within red blood cells. It is immune camouflaged, if you like. In addition, these spikes are encoded in the genome, and the bug has the capacity to make 50 or 60 different varieties of spikes. And so that also allows it to elude detection by the immune system. The immune system is one step behind. So let's begin. And we'll go as far as we can go, which is probably one drug, but a very key drug. Yes?
If you are able to actually treat a pregnant woman and keep her from dying from malaria?
Yeah. They can get into the brain. Cerebral malaria is a big issue. It's probably one of the problems in young children because the blood-brain barrier is not fully developed, making them more lethal. Yeah. But you're going to see the drugs that we're going to talk about are the antithesis almost from a pharmacokinetic point of view, physiological point of view for antibiotics. They're going to be lipid-soluble. They're all going to undergo metabolism. If you think about it, they're going to be relatively non-toxic, okay? And they have to be able to get here because that is a potential sanctuary. The place I want to begin, and you can organize these in various ways. One way to organize these drugs is to, they are, many of these drugs are quinolone derivatives. This is simply the quinolone ring system. And the first group that we're going to talk about are those quinolone drugs. So this is aromatic, it's planar, it's got an amino group and an amino group that are substituted at this 4 position. And the prototype that we're going to talk about is chloroquine. And chloroquine is a blood schizanticide. Chloroquine is used to treat the clinical attack, the clinical symptoms. Now, if you say, how does chloroquine work? The understanding of mechanism of action and selective toxicity becomes less precise as one gets to more complex organisms. Here, I'm going to give you a simple picture, then I'm going to go to your handout and talk you through it as to what's going on. For this organism to survive inside the red blood cell, it has to catabolize, break down hemoglobin in order to get required essential amino acids. So it breaks down the hemoglobin. And it does this in the lysosome of the plasmodium, or the food vacuole. It's been described various ways. So it breaks down the hemoglobin to obtain the essential required amino acids for development. And in the process, it makes a byproduct, we'll call it soluble heme. And this is toxic. And so the organism has a way to take that toxic heme, that soluble heme, and polymerize it into a heme polymer that's non-toxic. This is also known as malaria pigment. Chloroquine and, we'll see, related compounds function to inhibit this polymerase enzyme, thus blocking the detoxification of the soluble heme to the non-toxic polymer, building up soluble heme that leads to lysozyme degradation, red blood cell degradation, and the release of the organism and the destruction of the organism. Now let me step back and go to your picture. It's in your handout. This is simply a jazzed up version of what I just described. Here's the hemoglobin that has the amino acids that the bug needs. the organism metabolizes, breaks down the hemoglobin to get the essential amino acids, and that gives rise to heme that under normal conditions gets polymerized to the soluble or to the insoluble heme polymer that's non-toxic. Chloroquine blocks this polymerase step, leading to the accumulation of toxic soluble heme that degrades the lysosomal enzyme as well as, or lysosomal membrane as well as the membrane of the red blood cell. And so what happens? The red blood cell lyses, you get a loss of red blood cell, you get anemia, you get a drop in the hematocrit, one of the classic symptoms of the disease. Now, chloroquine has been, notice the past tense, for many years the bedrock treatment of malaria, particularly falciparum, but all forms. But falciparum, I said, was like Staph aureus. Falciparum has become resistant to chloroquine and, in fact, to a number of other blood schizanticides. And so the question is, what's the mechanism of action of chloroquine resistance? You read a lot about it. It is a major global concern. And let me see if I can talk you through the mechanism of resistance, and then I'll show you a picture to hopefully amplify that for you. The mechanism of resistance to chloroquine involves decrease amount of drug in the lysosome. Decreased concentration of drug in the food vacuole at the site of hemoglobin breakdown. And the decreased amount of drug is the result of the induction or amplification of an efflux pump that pumps chloroquine out of the lysosome. Are you with me? It is going to be analogous to, but not identical to, a pumping mechanism that you see in human cells that is critically important in resistance to cancer drugs. It's called P-glycoprotein. This pump pumps compounds that are aromatic, planar, basic, or protonated. And we're going to see it's a huge problem in cancer cells. In the falciparum malaria, a similar pump exists. Now, I just found this diagram, and I don't want you to write it, okay? But I just want to talk you through this picture that came out recently. This, let me just orient you, okay? This is hopefully another visual of the same thing. Here's the red blood cell. Here's the parasite in the red blood cell. And here's the lysosome of that parasite. That lysosome is acidic. So it makes it a piece of cake for chloroquine that's a base to enter by diffusion and become trapped. It becomes ion trapped. So the base diffuses in, becomes protonated. The amino acids that are produced as a result of breakdown of hemoglobin are protonated because it's acidic, and they're pumped out. This pump, under normal conditions in sensitive falciparum, preferentially pumps out the protonated amino acids, probably has little effect on protonated chloroquine. This pump in resistant organisms is mutated such that it now has greater affinity for chloroquine and less for the protonated amino acids, such that the chloroquine is pumped out, the level of chloroquine in the lysosome is reduced, and the polymerization step now can continue. Here, where chloroquine is sequestered and the concentration is higher in the non-resistant, it blocks the polymerization step. Last sentence. Chloroquine resistance is due to increased efflux of the drug out of the lysosome. And it's not going to just be chloroquine, okay? We're going to see it also plays with other drugs. So now you've just shot out of the sky really the premier drug for the treatment of the severe clinical attack in falciparum. You've been great, and I'm a little over, and I will see you on Monday, and we will sort of go back and jog the memory before we move forward.